Today's Teisho will be on case 41 in the Heikigan Roku, in the Tien Lu, that Blue Rock collection. Case 41 is entitled Joshu and the Great Death. Engo's introduction. When right and wrong are intermingled, even the holy ones cannot distinguish between them. When positive and negative are interwoven, even the Buddha fails to discern one from the other. The most distinguished person of transcendent experience cannot avoid showing his ability as a great master. He walks the ridge of an iceberg. He treads the edge of a sword. He is like the Kirin's horn, like the lotus flower in the fire. Meeting a person of transcendent experience, he identifies with him as his equal. Who is he? See the following. Main subject, Joshu asked Tosu, what if a man of the great death comes back to life again? Tosu said, you should not go by night. Wait for the light of day and come. Secho's verse. Open-eyed, he was all the more as if dead. What use to test the master with something taboo? Even the Buddha said he has not reached there. Who knows when to throw ashes in another's eyes? Today is the third day of our beautiful spring sesshin, and I want to thank everybody again for doing an excellent job this morning. Everybody was sitting very, very still in the zendo, including the new people, and everybody's performance was quite impressive, but I'm really pretty amazed by the first-timers at the sesshin. You're really doing a wonderful job. When I went to my first sesshin, getting through a half an hour sit was a major challenge. And by about the second day, I just in my mind I was just sort of crawling around. I was just seeing there was nothing I could do that wasn't painful. I'm sure people looking at me could see that I was like a wet dog in the rain, you know. Everybody here who's here for the first time is just really doing a superb job. So I'm very glad, you know. Please keep going. And I consider it good if people are, the best thing is if after 3 days, if you're a beginner, if you're still here, right, that's a great thing, right? Anything else is just gravy, as we say. But just being here is wonderful. Usually people, when they leave, they decide to leave at the evening of day two. And it has happened, believe me. We'll be sitting in the zendo, and you can hear the cart tires going on the gravel as they go out to the road. There was one case a couple of years ago where a person just really didn't belong at sesshin. She had come to a sesshin earlier and had, I don't know what kind of an experience, but she came to a second one. And during the whole time she had there was some psychological dynamic going on, and she was sort of mad at me the whole time. And this was in August. It was an August session, which is quite hot. And you might have noticed that over there's a pool. And swimming in the pool is not part of sesshin. It's not part of Zen practice, Zen tradition. So it's not like, It's 8 o'clock, zazen, 9 o'clock, pool. So it is hot, in August. If you've been here, you know. And she was just so teed off, and she came in and let me know. She said, we're not allowed to use the pool, anyway, it was like that. Every time I came in, I could do nothing right? So if I said something during the Tay Show, she'd take offense and come in and argue with me about it. I just couldn't win, and she would, basically she'd tell me that, I don't know about this thing. This seems a little bit sick to me, it seems really weird. And why can't we get more sleep? Why do we all have to eat at the same time? There's no sense really engaging in certain kinds of conversations, So at some point I finally just said, look, if you don't want to be here, you don't have to be here. And that was at 8 o'clock Dobasan in the evening, right? And so, I did try to encourage her to stick it out. I said, people get tired, they get grouchy, but if you just stick with it, you'll find that you turn a corner. But I said, please understand, if you don't want to be here, that's okay too. If you leave here, you won't be going to hell. She left the Dogasan room, and I guess I thought, well, maybe that solved the problem, And so then I came out for tea, and I noticed there was nobody in her cushion, and it was just like zoom, right? So she took me seriously, I guess. But that happens, sometimes people have left the sesshin and come back. I've never had anybody leave the sesshin and come back during the same sesshin. That's never happened. That might happen someday, but that would be very interesting, Somebody said, when these people drive away, I do have a fantasy where I think, they're going to get on the turnpike and go, what am I doing? I've turned my back on the greatest experience of my life. And turn around and come back and go, they'd be back, so she'd be back on the cushion the next day. And I go, thank you for realizing. So far that hasn't happened. They get on the turnpike and they haven't come back. That's a sheen. But a number of people have come back after leaving sesshin. They've left and then they've come back, and some of them have become very, very serious members of our group. There's one person who, I think he must have left sesshin 4 or 5 times. Really? Yeah. Really, it would be like, we used to have sesshin at my house, and we had a little kitchen, and we only would have say 6 or 7 people, eight people maybe, in the living room, and the people would be sitting in the living room, and I would be in the kitchen, I'd be scrambling around trying to get everything ready, and then I'd see this person. If it were day two, all of a sudden I'd realize, oh, it's day two. Because he'd have his coat on. He'd have the coat on. And he'd be, I'm out of here, Really, this is true. And this was like, really, you could set your watch. You could say day two, finally, one time I said, look, if you go, don't come back. I actually said, this is it, if you leave, you're just wasting your time, But the person actually came later and went through a whole session and has become quite a good sitter, I would say, quite a good practitioner. So people have different kinds of struggles with Zen practice. A friend of mine came to visit recently, and I won't use his name, but he and I started practicing together 30-some years ago. And we both started practicing under Takabayashi Genki, Roshi in Seattle. And we started training together. And for some reason, he stopped practicing. And we went to a number of sesshin together, like many, like for 7 years or something. And he disappeared. He stopped practicing. We had some problems in our group, I should say, that we had some unfortunate issues that caused a lot of unhappiness in our group because of disagreements between our two teachers, our two main teachers. And it caused much friction and ultimately the group split in two. And some people became very disillusioned, and one of the people who became disillusioned was my friend. And he stopped practicing shortly after I left Seattle. So I guess we had practiced together for 10 years almost. I didn't really stay in touch with him until recently, but he came to stay at my house, he was here to see his son, who was going to school up in New England at Brown University, and he called me. He sent me an email actually, and he said, "It'd be nice to see you. It's been a long time, and I'd like to come in and just see you after all these years. We used to practice Zen together." And I said, "You're very welcome to come." And I have to say that he was, very handsome guy, like a super handsome person. I know he had a good relationship with my wife, He's like almost too good, you know what I mean? He's so handsome, And I know, we used to have blackberries growing along. We lived in Seattle right next to the bike path. We had a bike path that's the rails to trails path in Seattle, and it goes all around Lake Washington. And it's wonderful because you could get on your bike and go all the way downtown. And in Seattle, all these wild blackberries grow along the bike path, and you could just go out with a bucket and pick blackberries. One time we had Bill over to the house. Oh, there's his name. Oh, we had Bill over to the house, That's not his real name. So we had Bill over to the house, and Barbara made the dinner, and she made a big blackberry pie, which she'd never made for me. And Bill said, "Oh, I really like this pie. It was really good. And every time he'd see her, he'd say, "Oh, that blackberry pie was just great." Barbara would go, "Oh, you have to come again. I'll make you another pie." It was like, she's never made me a pie. So anyway, Bill came to see us after many years, and he's still very handsome, but I was happy to see that he had gained about 60 pounds. So he looked the same right up to his chest, and then gained a lot of weight. He said, "I love to eat," and I said, "Maybe pies, I guess." He was haunted. I'm not trying to tell you that you shouldn't do Zen. Zen isn't everybody's cup of tea. It's just not. There are many paths in life. Within Buddhism itself, there's Vipassana. And there's Tibetan Buddhism. Zen or Chan is not everybody's path in life. And so, if you decide you don't want to practice, I'm fine with that, So I'm not telling the story to say, if you were to leave or something, you'd regret it. But it was interesting because this person, he came to see me, and he did talk about how much he he regretted not continuing his practice, you know. And he really was unhappy. He felt that something was, you know, he felt that he had found something very valuable and had sort of closed the door on it. And now he was 30 years older, and he found himself feeling that same old hunger that had brought him to the cushion before, you know. And he was really, it was like he was really not happy with his life, you know. And by conventional standards, he should have been happy, you know. He is married to a very nice woman who's a psychologist, a professional psychologist, and very successful. And he has two or three sons, and they're all very, I met one of them, he seems like a very nice young man. He's politically left-leaning, so I was happy to see that, you know. And so he's a nice, very articulate, nice. So, you know, here's somebody who ought to be conventionally, and he's a builder. He has a company, he builds houses. He built his own house, you know. So he ought to be happy with his life, but there's something missing. Something is missing, you know, in his life. And he felt this great sense of, like a missed opportunity, or he'd taken the wrong path in life, and he really was unhappy. I think he wanted to talk to me about it, and so he had some problems with the way Zen operates. He didn't like. You know, we all eat at the same time, this sort of stuff. So that bugged him. But all the same, he felt something was missing. There's something about, I think, something about this practice which is like nothing else, you know, in our society, I think. That is, if this is your path in life, there's nothing like this, you know. It's just such a wonderful experience. You know, there's something about it that's just, I think, really magical. We're coming here for all kinds of reasons, you know. I practiced Zen because it made me feel better. I was such an unhappy person. And I was very unhappy. And when I did Zazen, even though it was difficult, I felt happier, you know. I just felt happier, and it was, I couldn't make myself feel better any other way, you know, really better. And so, you know, even though I didn't like getting up at 4:30 in the morning, when I would go to Sesshin and come home from Sesshin, I would feel better, you know, much better. And you know, other people might be here for other reasons, you know, maybe they have a lot of problems, you know, in their life, and they're trying to get some perspective, or maybe they've made mistakes and they're trying to make amends. You know, that's quite common. People sometimes come to Sesshin because they've made a big mistake and they're trying to set their life in order. So there's many reasons to be at Sesshin, but I think, I think we all have our personal reasons, but I think on a deeper level, I think our motive is even deeper than that. I think there's just something inside of us that has told us to practice. I really believe this, you know. It's like you just have to do something. You just have to do something. And it might be the craziest thing, you know. But I have a number of friends who are artists. My sister-in-law, for example, is an artist, and she's really a great artist. I think her work is so beautiful. She's utterly unknown and unappreciated. You know, really. It's quite sad. But the world of artists is very competitive, and there's a lot of junk out there, and there's a lot of famous people who make junk. And then there's a lot of really good artists who don't get any press coverage. Just the other day, somebody sent me a link online to an artist And she just knocked my socks off. I thought she was so good. And you know, anyway, that's the way it is. So my sister-in-law, whose name is Sydney, has you could say she's been a servant of the goddess of art all her life. And the goddess has not really like been that generous to her. You know what I mean? But all the same, she has great. I think the core of her life is very whole. And I think she's a very alive person, because she's been true to this voice in herself. You know, I think she's basically a healthy and sound person, and I think she has a great energy, and I think joy, because she's been true to what we call in Zen our true nature. You know, her father was an engineer, and he. He was a very nice man. My father-in-law is a very nice man, but he's a very practical person. You know, so he just thought that Sydney's becoming an artist was like a crazy decision. You know, he tried to discourage her, and he said things like, "You'll never make any money, you know, selling your paintings. You know, the chances of becoming a big." You know, there are these artists who live like kings, right? You know, they literally make millions of dollars, but they're so rare. They're like, great basketball players. You know, everybody's practicing, but only a handful of people become famous basketball players. You know, so it's sort of like that. And he tried to discourage her, but you know, she did this, and out of her, from her hands have come this sequence of hauntingly beautiful paintings and statues, she even does ceramics. She's really just like, she just keeps exploring different art forms, and her paintings are like, if I don't know how to put it, but. We have one of her paintings. It's a picture of geese, and it's like if geese could dream, and we could see their dreams and paint them, the painting would look like that. It's like this is what a goose's dream looks like. You know, it's just a beautiful, powerful piece of work. You know, so I think we come to Sesshin, we're like that artist. You know, there's so many things. We could do, but there's some part of us that's giving us an order. It said, "Come to Sesshin," there's all kinds of things, reasons not to come. You know, there's all kinds of, we've got bills to pay. You know, this and that. And this, I could be working on this. I could be doing. You know, and we can rationalize in other ways too. Because I've been working on that stupid koan. You know, I'm never going to answer that darn koan. Why don't I do something that's where I at least get success once in a while, something like that. You know, oddly, if you listen to that voice, and it may not tell you to do something, it may tell you to be an artist. You know, but if that voice tells you to come and practice Chan, to come and practice Zen, and you listen to it, I think you'll really be liberated. You really won't regret it, and this is what Chan is all about. This is what Zen is all about. We practice a kind of Zen here, which is called Linji Chan, Rinzai Zen. And Linji was a very interesting person. You know, I've talked a lot about Joshu. But Linji was just this very, very dynamic person, a really deep practitioner. And he was a contemporary of Joshu in the later part of the Tang Dynasty. And, Joshu was supposed to be really like a big guy. He was really big, you know. So when I think of Joshu, I think of somebody who's like 6'2 and weighs 250, you know. Linji was like very small, very small person, and but equally powerful, you know, in his way of living. And he was apparently, you know, totally. If you didn't know he was, if you didn't, somebody didn't say that is Lin Ji, you'd never guess. You know, just this totally ordinary monk, but great dynamism, great insight. You know, and of course Lin Ji was famous because, you know, he was the one who used to slap people. You know, so you come into Dokusan and go, oh, I don't know. You know. So he'd push him, slap him, you know. But he just cut through the crap, you know. And he used to, you know, you have to understand that even though we can idealize China, at that time people had a very great respect for enlightenment. But nevertheless, China was, like the United States today, a very hierarchical society. In other words, Americans think this is a democracy, but it's actually a political democracy, but it's actually quite a hierarchy, right? I mean, somebody like Bill Gates makes, I couldn't even do the math in my head right now, but, you know, he makes millions of times the money I make, you know? So we're not all equal in the United States, you know? I don't resent his wealth, but it's just an illusion to think that's not so. You know, we get many messages in our society that say, get to the top, don't wind up on the bottom. So China was like this too. You know, basically, China was a hierarchy, and at the top of the hierarchy were people who were extremely learned people. You know, these were the Mandarin, you know, and they knew all the classics. They studied Confucius. They studied the Book of Odes, the great ancient Chinese poetry, and so on. And they wrote beautiful calligraphy, and they had this beautiful, they knew all the characters, you know, and so on. And the average person in China, the average person, felt like a dope and a powerless person, you know. And so, you know, basically all the power and was at the top, and everybody felt inferior and unworthy. And Lin Ji used to go around and say, listen, you know, in you, there is he used to say, the person, there's a person without rank. See, everybody in China had a rank. So the emperor, you know, then the under the emperor, rank number two. This is like my dad, right? GS 20, GS 18. Lin Ji used to say, inside of you there's a person with no rank, you know, and he goes and comes with no obstacles, you know, and he has no birth and no death, you know. And so he says, don't look up there and admire those people to the top, you know. In you there's something far more wonderful than that, you know. It's your true nature, you know. Buddha, God, you know, it's not in Rome. And it's not in Tibet, you know. It's in you, you know. And so Lin Ji was like a shot in the arm for people, because he would say, you know, don't wish you were someone else. Don't wish you were somewhere else. You know, in you there is this true nature, you know. And of course, he was tremendously influential. Almost all the temples in China became Lin Ji temples. The point is that Zen life is about living, serving, being the servant of your true nature. Yeah, being the servant of your true nature, and listening to that voice and doing what it says, basically, even if it tells you to get up at 4:30 in the morning, right? I mean, you know, it's not necessarily pleasant to get up at 4:30 in the morning and do zazen for an hour and a half, right? Your legs hurt, and of course, by day two of the session, you get to feel very, very worn out. Yeah, maybe that's how you feel right now, but. more typically, it's like day two. Now, you know, everybody gets tired. I want to tell you the truth that, you know, I love getting ready for Sesshin, but actually, you know, it's tiring a little bit, you know. So we all have to get ready. We do all these preparations. You know, I load up my car, I do grocery shopping, I do a number of things, and when I come to Sesshin and we get everything set, I'm a little bit tired, you know. And then the next day, we start sitting, and it's strenuous. And I'll tell you, on Wednesday night, I was in the Dokusan room. It was 9 o'clock. We'd had 9:30. We'd had tea and the bathroom break. And I went into the Dokusan room and I thought, oh, I should have had more tea. You know, I'm really tired, right? I'm very excited by what people tell me in Dokusan, but I mean, I was really tired. I was looking at my, you know, just like you. I'm looking at my watch and I think, okay, it's 9:30. You know, and we start doing Dokusan, I treat Dokusan like meditation, so I don't uncross. You might think I'm in there uncrossing my legs, but I'm not. I don't uncross them the whole time, really. I swear to you, that's true. It's between me and my true nature, but it's a promise I made to my true nature, you know. You think 9:30, okay, I can do this, you know, and then you look, it's 9:40. Darn, you know, and then you're like, 9:55, you know. You think, oh, man, I don't know if I can make it, right? So that happens to me too. You know, that happens to me too. You're doing the koans, right? And so, you know, you might think, you know, I toss these koans to you, and then, you know, I just, you know, good luck, you know. But I actually think about, you know, everybody's practice, and I lie in bed at night and think, you know, how can I help this person? You know, how can I, maybe I said the wrong thing, you know. I don't agonize over it, but I'm not in pain, but I'm eager to see you succeed, you know, and I take it very seriously. So even though you might think, you know, I'm giving you these hideous koans, you know, I am, and even Hakuin said these vile koans, right? In the grip of a koan, you're struggling with a koan. It's like sometimes like bashing your head against a wall, you know. But it's not like I'm thinking, you know, we'll see how this goes. Yeah, they'll never get out of this one, you know. It's not like that at all, you know. I'm concerned. I'm rooting for you, you know. By the middle of day two, I'm tired, you know. I came in and sat down on the cushion last night, and it was just, you know, it's a rough day, you know. I have an earache. I don't know why. I think I must have some kind of an infection, you know. You sit on a cushion, and you're tired, and then all of a sudden it's like coming back from the dead, you know. It's like the energy, it's like something clicks, and it's like, oh, this is so great, you know, so great, you know. And then last night Dokusan was like, huh. It's like a little party in there for me. You know? Really, it was great. It was great to see everybody. I felt great. I was happy, you know. Wasn't looking at my watch, you know. It's that energy. So, you know, there's a rhythm to practice. There's a rhythm to practice. The first couple of days, you reach the limits of your personal energy. If you're really practicing sincerely, that's going to happen to you, you know. And then you're in this terrible predicament because you're out of gas, You know, you don't have the answer to your koan. So you're blinded. It's like being in the dark. Your car is stalled. You don't know where you are, and you're not going to reach your destination. You know, and you can be frightened. You can be mad, and so on. But at some point, it's like you just have to die on the cushion, and this energy will come. You know. And learning how to do this, you know, basically, if you do sesshin long enough, you just go through this process again and again and again, and you begin to have trust in the process. You know, I mean, it does sometimes happen to me that I'm sitting on the cushion thinking, "Ooh, my legs really hurt. You know, come on, baby. You know, you know, when is it going to happen? You know, come on, I'm ready. You know, anytime now. You know." And sometimes it doesn't. I get off the cushion. Whew, you know, but sooner or later it's going to happen, and you feel so good. You feel so alive. You know, if that hasn't happened to you yet, just keep dying, please. You know, now you have to really die for this to happen. You know, if you're trying to make it happen, if your car isn't out of gas, you're not lost, you're not in the dark, and it's cold, and you're worried, you know, basically that's sort of like the usual situation. So you have to go through a process of like emptying out yourself, you know, and if you don't do that, the other part doesn't happen, you know. So it takes great courage to go through this process. You know, it takes great courage to relinquish your control and to trust your big mind. We basically would like to believe in the big mind, but it's very hard to believe in it, right? Basically there's a lot of fear and anxiety. We just feel that the car is going to sit there and nothing is going to happen. It may be even, you might go through many sesshins like that, you know. But if you just hang in there, sooner or later, that energy is going to come. And it's like being connected to the energy of the universe, you know, really and truly. Some people have had that experience, even at this sesshin. Last sesshin, somebody came in to see me and had been in terrible pain and came in to see me and just said, "I don't know what's happened, but my pain is just like blown away." Yeah? Now, you know, if you're having struggles with pain, you can't imagine this scenario and make it happen, you know. You just have to sit on the cushion and keep emptying yourself out. And by emptying yourself out, I mean you watch the breath and you go out with the breath, out, out, out. And there's this little blank space at the end of your breath, and you keep returning to that place. And little by little, your awareness is going to change, you know. You may be you're not going to be thinking so much, yeah, and basically you're going to be start experiencing things in a rather different way, you know, very few thoughts. You might have different kind of body sensations. You know, you might just feel parts of your body. Your hearing will be acute, you know, probably. But it will, you know, you'll go in and out of awareness of the moment, and you'll just just keep watching that blankness, and then you're in the moment in the way I just described, and then you watch the blankness and you're in the moment, and of course you're aware there's some pain in your legs or something, but you keep going back. This is what we mean by saying emptying out or dying on the cushion. If you keep doing this, you know, you will get tired, but little by little you're sort of taking away you're drawing back all the curtains, right? All the illusions, and taking off all your masks, you could say, and you're gradually drawing closer to your true nature. You know, they're really, you know, we have many, many layers of defensiveness. You know, stories we tell, dreams we've held on to, and they actually all get in the way. You know, to tell you the truth, you know, we think our ideas are real, but often we've created all these things just to protect us. You know, this happened to me recently. A couple of years ago, my brother died. He had cancer. And he had a very difficult period, and finally he died. And my mother was declining in mental health. She was having some problems with Alzheimer's. And, you know, when Peter died, we weren't sure whether we should tell my mother or not, because she was able to understand many things in the world, but her emotional situation was very volatile. So, you know, she easily lost control over her emotions, and she you know, would react like in an exaggerated way to things. So we were really, she was doing pretty well. We didn't want to destabilize her, and yet we knew we had to tell her son had died. So we finally did tell her, the interesting thing was that she didn't come to the funeral. We didn't bring her to the funeral. But shortly after the funeral, my mother called me, and she said, I was still down there in Virginia. She called me and said, I'm looking for my white book. I have a white book. Have you seen it? And I said, I don't know what book you mean, Mother. You know, first of all, I had no idea what book she's talking about. You know, she has a house full of books. And she says, the white book, you know, no. And then she drove all the way over to my sister's house and accused my sister of stealing her white book. She said, I want the, well, you know, it sounds crazy, but, you know, my brother, actually, you know, my brother had blonde hair, you know, and so on, very, very fair complexion. I think she was upset about my brother's dying, and she concealed it. With this story about losing her white book, right? And she was very upset. She was so upset she was crying at my mother's house. At my sister's house. And she said, "Where? They've taken my book, you know." And she's like a little kid. She said, "Mom, you know, we'll get you another book." But of course, the book she wanted was my brother, you know. But I think humans do this all the time, right? You know, you meet people who say, I went to college with a guy who used to say, I'm going to be a millionaire at 50. No question about it, right? You know, and he was a business, MBA. He said, no question, I'm going to be a millionaire. I'm going to be very, very rich. Really? He used to say that. His name was Mike Mercer. We were like totally opposites, you know, in every way, you know. He supported the war in Vietnam. You know, he was going to be a millionaire. It was like on and on, you know. So anyway, he told me, no, I know, I'm going to be very successful. And I used to say, Mike, the chances of you're becoming a millionaire, here's, you know, no, I know, I'm good. So, you know, he wanted to be a millionaire, this was the program. And you think, why did he want to be a millionaire? You know, I think that was like a story, that's like my mother's white book. You know what I mean? There was something else that he was afraid of. It wasn't really about being a millionaire. There's something else that was driving him, you know? Something else that he didn't want himself to see. So he told this story, I'm going to be a millionaire, right? But he had pulled the curtains around something that he was afraid of looking at, yeah? And in doing so, he closed himself off from his true nature. Yeah? More and more, to protect ourselves, we create these little stories, you know, these little stories, these little fantasies and so on, and pretty soon, you know, it's very hard to be real to ourselves. You know, so Zen practice, you might think, is like, you know, the hard work of Zen practice is clearing away these things and trying to see you know, trying to see our true nature face to face. And it's a little bit difficult because we don't necessarily want to pull the curtains back. You know, they have protected us for so long. You know, they've protected us. And we're afraid, now, I do want to become enlightened, but don't pull back that curtain, you know, please. He said, ah, that's the one you have to pull back. Yeah. Yeah, anyone but that, you know. See, some of you might know Oscar Wilde. He's an English writer. And he's famous for saying, I can resist anything but temptation. I think that's great, right? You know? I love that. I can resist anything but temptation. Yeah. So it's like, I want to be open and free, but I don't want to, you know, please, but the only thing I don't want to lose are the curtains that I have drawn around myself to protect myself, right? So it, let me be open, but don't take any of these curtains away, you know. But see, I mean, the hard work of Zen practice is moving those curtains aside. And with one hand, we're trying to pull them aside, but with the other hand, is hanging on to the curtain for dear life, right? So there's a little bit of a tug of war that goes on sometimes. And of course, anyway, I think you see the point. Many of the things that people believe are not true. They're true in a kind of strange way. You know, they're true like my mother's white book was lost. You know, it's hard to see the world as it actually is until we do. And then it turns out to be 100% wonderful. So you know, we sit on the cushion, we straighten the back, we watch the breath, and we have to do some hard work. But if you empty the self out, and that can involve struggling with these stories we've told ourselves, cutting through these stories, giving up on these stories, you know, eventually it becomes possible to have a little taste of this boundless energy, and the more we strip away, the more that energy is accessible to us. It takes a long time and a lot of courage and trust, but I'm sure you've already had moments in your Zen practice where you know that you won't be disappointed, right? And you haven't been disappointed. So please don't be afraid, and don't be don't be afraid. Just keep emptying yourself out, and only good things will come to you. When right and wrong are intermingled, even the holy ones cannot distinguish between them. We've surrounded ourselves, some of it's true, some of it's dream, right? In that condition, how do you, how do you get out of it? And then he says, the most distinguished person of transcendent experience cannot avoid showing his ability as a great master. So they say, but, you know, most of us are screwed up, but there is a great master. There is. You know, you might be thinking, yes, the Dalai Lama, right? You know, or for me, it was Genki Roshi. I used to think, no, he's a Zen master. You know, when I first met Genki, I was almost unable to speak. I was so, he's a very nice man, but I had read all these books on Zen, and I thought approaching a Zen master would, you know, he might, I don't know what I expected, but I was just so intimidated. You know, I wanted so much to be a good student to Genki Roshi. I wanted so much to be. I was so afraid that he would see me for what I really was. You know, and I was afraid for him to see that I really wasn't a very nice person. I was a very unhappy person, and I was not particularly nice. And so on and so on. And so in his presence, I just felt this huge gap between him and me. You know, he was like a great mountaintop, and I was like this guy at the bottom of the of the Death Valley or something. You know. But actually, it wasn't like that. You know, first of all, the more I got to know Genki Roshi, the more I saw he was just a very nice human being who liked sake and udon. You know, and didn't always show up for his appointments. You know? Including zazen, right? Yeah. Which was annoying. You know, I eventually realized this great mountaintop can be a pain in the ass. But the other thing is, you know, when you do enough zazen, you realize, you know, the person spoken of here, the person of transcendent experience, who walks over the mountains. You know, walks the mountain ranges, is you. Hard to believe, yeah. But just keep dying on the cushion. Keep emptying out, and you will find that great master in yourself. Really and truly, it seems hard to believe, but just keep going. Main subject. Joshu asked Tosu, if a person of the great death comes back to life, what if a person of the great death comes back to life again? And Tosu said, you should not go by night. Wait for the light of day to come. You know, just a lot of Zen is sitting in darkness, but sooner or later something is going to stir, you know, and then you'll be so alive and you'll be so happy. Secho's verse, open-eyed, he was all the more as if dead. What use to test the master with something taboo? Even the Buddha said he had not reached there. Who knows when to throw ashes in another's eyes? So we have all thrown ashes in our own eyes, but now we have a chance to clean things up a little bit. So let's use this wonderful time, this precious opportunity. Really, I mean, stay free. You know, it's going to be gone like that. And some of you are thinking, great. But I'm thinking, too fleeting. And I this precious time with my true nature, you know, it's so sweet. So please just keep practicing with diligence.